The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
This is Faith Crutch. I'm reading This Doesn't Appear to Be the Alien I Paid For by Andrea G. Stewart. 1532 Mayberry Lane, New Haven, BR, 83623, Athena, Milky Way, Perseus Arm. August 1st, 2313, Grow Life Science Kits, Inc., Consumer Complaint Division, 41 West Harbor Lane, Brecon, YA, 26854, Podunk, Andromeda, New Outer. Dear Sir or Madam, when my 7-year-old daughter asked for a pet, I sensed an opportunity to teach her something about the universe. I'd seen your ads while browsing the net, while catching an episode of my favorite Holo, and while utilizing the urinal on the 5th floor of my office. Yes, your ads are everywhere. Why buy her a puppy when I can get her a Moggin? I'd help her care for it through its larval stage. We'd watch it pupate, and once it emerged, she'd get 2 years of watching the critter scurrying around its tank. As you may have guessed, reality did not meet my expectations. Admittedly, your company responded promptly to my order. Although intergalactic shipping can be slow and tedious, my Grow Life kit arrived in 12 days. Our Moggin slept in its stasis cube, the green light blinking in time to its heartbeat. It was an endearing thing, the size of my thumb and covered in green fuzz. Everything you'd promised was included in the kit. The bag of larval food, the clear plastic habitat, the information booklet, and enough gravel and fake plants to make the habitat look like a real podunk. As soon as my daughter opened the box, she wanted to unpack the terrarium and wake the Moggin. I don't think she even remembered asking for a puppy. According to the booklet, we'd received a plum-eared Moggin. This species was docile and sweet, and would grow to the size of a dwarf hamster. For the first 2 weeks, I had no complaints. We spent father-daughter time playing with the Moggin. Its 18 legs tickled our palms, and its pink eyes were adorable. But by the 3rd week, we were low on larval food, and the Moggin showed no signs of pupating. No swollen belly, no increased lethargy, no dullness to its fuzz. I called your customer service line. This happens sometimes, your representative assured me. Although I expressed concerns, Christopher said that Grow Life implements a strict policy of quality control and that only licensed xenobiologists are authorized to care for the company's larvae. 2 weeks later, our Moggin pupated. Its chrysalis was not the seafoam green your booklet promised. I would have described it more as a fresh bruise or unsightly rash. My daughter was delighted when the creature emerged, but upon comparison to the art in the booklet, I noticed a few differences. As expected, our Moggin had 6 legs and short fur. But its fur was light brown instead of dark, with a narrow strip of red running down its back. The red stripes contained a number of tiny spines. Your reading material, while elaborating on the Moggin's teddy bear eyes, failed to mention these. It was not the size of a dwarf hamster. A standard hamster? Perhaps. To my consternation, our Moggin wasn't interested in a varied diet of fresh fruits and vegetables. After 2 days of refusing everything we offered, during which my daughter cried herself to sleep and wondered if her pet was going to die, our Moggin began to eat raw ground beef and to grow. I called your customer service line again. This time, Linda, without listening to my full complaint, told me that there will be some variation in the color of the Moggins and that each Moggin has its own food preferences. I tried to interrupt her, but she firmly reminded me that your company does not offer exchanges on adolescent Moggins and that the 30-day refund policy had expired. It was the growth of our 8-month Moggin spines that prompted me to do my own research. Imagine my surprise when I found out that plum-eared Moggins do not exist. We'd been saddled with Mogginus clavermuculus, the crimson-striped Moggin. I'd refrain from explaining since you have licensed xenobiologists on staff, but clearly they require remedial instruction in species identification. The crimson-striped mogan grows to the size of a wombat, has poisonous spines on its back, and is carnivorous. Its lifespan is not the quaint 2 years claimed, but 30 years. Although I was tempted to set the mogan loose in a nearby park, further research unveiled that they can reproduce at 1 year of age through parthenogenesis. Crimson-striped mogans are considered an invasive species and are banned on 58 planets. I have neither the desire nor resources to house its creature's offspring. Did you know they can produce 25 babies at one time? Did you? Especially since it escaped one night and has acquired a taste for domestic felines. A third call to your customer service line resulted in Darren pointing out fine print on the back of your booklet. It is the responsibility of the buyer to check all local laws and restrictions regarding mogans. When I told him that Grow Life had sent me the wrong species, he argued that this was impossible. When I explained that our mogan had devoured the neighbor's cat and asked to speak to his supervisor, he told me he didn't have one. Due to your company's general incompetence, I am the owner of an alien species that is illegal on my planet. Or, I was until early last week. By now you may have received my unmarked package. This may be too late, but it would be prudent to exercise caution when opening it. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to afford an appropriately sized stasis cube for our crimson-striped mogan. But not to worry. My research tells me that our mogan can survive up to 3 weeks without food, though this makes them quite unsociable and likely to discharge their spines when slight provocation. Given our mogan's age, you may also find 25 or so little surprises in the box with it. Keep them, please. They are my gift to you. Sincerely, Richard Steiner.
This is Scott Youngkin reading Flipside by Chip Hauser. Squatting on the curb in front of a boarded-up duplex, a woman rocks back and forth, arms crossed, arguing with herself. You are driving too fast. He should have looked both ways. The sun is shining brightly. Her freckled flesh is sunburned, where it presses through tears in her dress. Meant for a slimmer frame, the dress is dingy and thin, the once bright floral pattern lost to wear and dirt. You weren't paying attention. Beside her feet huddle several grimy shopping bags and an empty bottle with a pirate on the label. She grabs it and, finding it empty, curses. Look before you cross, Tommy, she yells, hurling the bottle without looking. It skips and shatters across the street. Just beyond the ruined bottle, an elderly fellow in a threadbare suit leans on a wooden cane, watching wraparound sunglasses dwarf his head, which is covered in age spots, thinning hair, and beaded sweat. Tapping and sweeping the ground with his cane, he carefully navigates across the lumpy asphalt through the broken glass. The woman looks up when his shadow crosses her. Her eyes are red and angry. What do you want? Mind if I sit? Yes, she yells, leaning away. Her limp hair sways, heavy with grease. Who are you? Go away. The old man sits down. She clutches herself and scoots away from him. Patting away the sweat with a yellowed handkerchief, he says, I'm here to help. I said go away. He draws a small glass bottle from inside his jacket. It sparkles in the sunlight like the broken glass on the street. What's that? The woman snatches the bottle from him, cradling it protectively in both hands. The bottle holds what looks like a barbecue sauce, russet-colored with black flecks. Pulling the stopper, the woman sniffs it. Whiskey? Better than that. She tips the bottle, empties it. A trickle of sauce runs down the dirty crease at one corner of her mouth. She grabs her throat and gags. That's not whiskey, it's poison.
Your mind's poison, not my sauce. No, if that kid had just looked. The woman rubs her temples with dirty fingers. She looks confused, as if she's forgotten what she's talking about. She shakes her head as if trying to clear her mind. Her fingers, gripping the bottle tightly, have become slightly translucent. See? It's already working. Gently, the old man takes the bottle back. Relax now. It won't take long. Tommy's going to be just fine this time. The woman looks sharply at the old man. What did you say? You'll see. He clutches as she fades away to nothing. The old man tucks the bottle away, tilts his smile up toward the sun. A red convertible races along a narrow two-lane road, a rocky slope to the right dropping down to a sandy beach. The air is clean, the sun warm, the sky blue. The driver's hair blows in the wind while her dress, a bright floral print, flutters against her slender frame. She is smiling, paying no attention to her speed. As she steers into a curve, she sees a young girl crossing the road. It's too late to brake, but the girl is across in a flash. The woman does not notice the little boy crawling clumsily under the guardrail. Wait for me, he cries, running into the road. The car is going far too fast for the woman to stop. Too late, the girl turns back. Tommy, no! The boy stops, confused, directly in the rushing convertible's path. His head turns as if in slow motion, eyes widening, eyebrows raising, mouth forming an O. The woman jerks the wheel hard to the left, fishtailing into the oncoming lane, and back across again toward the guardrail. As the car strikes the guardrail, a dozen yards in front of the little boy, it flips into the air. The boy stands frozen, watching wide-eyed as the convertible whooshes over his head, so close he could reach up and touch the woman's streaming hair. There is no sound other than the screaming engine. He turns, watching the convertible slam onto the rocks below and burst into flames. Years later, the boy, now grown, crosses that same stretch of road. There is a crosswalk now and yellow signs, but people still drive too fast. As he crosses, he looks both ways, left, then right, then left again, and stops dead in the middle of the road, very near where he had as a boy. He has just remembered something from that day long ago. Why, he wonders, was the woman smiling as she sailed past?
Hi, this is Jackie Roble, and this story is called The Bitten Body by A.C. Spawn.
He was killed within the last 15 minutes, said Detective Faraday, trying to keep his eyes off the sprawled corpse. We have two suspects, but any insights you would have would be helpful, Professor Watt.
No need for titles, Detective, Kara Watt said absently as she knelt to examine the body. The man was in his late 20s. Light brown hair, green eyes. His throat had been savaged, ripped out by violent teeth. He lay between the two rows of sinks in the restaurant bathroom, his blood painting the marble tile beneath him.
I see the obvious cause of death, said Kara. But what happened to the back of his head?
Blunt force trauma. Looks like he fell against the sink during the...
feeding?
Attack.
Detective Faraday swallowed and avoided her eyes. Kara cocked her head.
Are you new to Watson Ridge, Detective?
Just transferred here last week.
Still getting used to the supernatural community?
Yeah.
He eyed her.
You're not... are you?
It's not polite to ask a lady if she's human. Turning back to the body, she asked, any sign of weapons?
Not natural ones, if that's what you mean.
Teeth are more natural than knives, aren't they?
The detective blanched. I didn't mean...
Relax, detective, I'm joking. Kara stood, then reached to turn off the still-running faucet with one gloved hand. The over-sink mirror reflected her wavy blonde hair and dark brown eyes. She was tall, almost the same height as the detective, though her work heels made their heights even today. She sucked in her cheeks, then blew out a thoughtful breath. I'm ready to talk to your suspects. Faraday made a short call, and a moment later three uniformed police officers escorted a pair of men into the bathroom. Detective Faraday made an uneasy movement, and Kara glanced in the mirror to see him fiddling with his watch.
She studied the four other reflections before turning to face her two suspects. One had pale orange eyes and long canines. The other had chest hair so long it poked above the top of his T-shirt. Kara looked at the hairy one. "We'll start with you, Wolf." The wolf shifter gave her a narrow-eyed glare. "I was enjoying a steak when I needed to mark some territory, if you get my drift." He jerked his chin at the orange-eyed man. "I came in and found that vampire standing over the body." "Untrue," said the orange-eyed vampire in a clipped tone. "I was the one who came in and found him with the corpse." Kara looked at Detective Faraday, who shrugged. "They were both here when officers responded. The throat's so torn up we can't tell which one attacked the man, but I have a dental consultant coming in to compare the bite marks to their teeth."
"No need for that," said Kara. "I can tell you right now who's guilty."
Kara waved toward the wolf. "Arrest him. He's your killer."
"What?" shouted the wolf. "You have no proof."
"The faucet was running, which means the victim was washing his hands when he was attacked," said Kara. "But the back of his head hit the sink. He must have seen his attacker in the mirror and turned around to defend himself." She pointed at the mirror, at the six reflections for seven people. "As you can see, this vampire has no reflection. The victim wouldn't have seen him coming, therefore he can't be the killer." As the officers hauled the still protesting wolf from the bathroom, Detective Faraday shook his head.
"This assignment will take some getting used to."
"They all say that at first." Kara stripped off her plastic gloves and then pulled a business card from her pocket. "Here," she said, handing it to Faraday. "The other cops have this, but if you need me, call that number."
"P.I.," Faraday read. "Paranormal investigator. Does that first word describe you or your work?"
Kara laughed as she headed for the door. She did not answer.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This story is titled After the First Comes the Last by Holly Lynn Walrath. When Araya cast the first spell, it was like filling a quarry in her belly she never knew existed. Saying the words and knowing they would work filled her with a sensation of wholeness, with the utter totality of truth. And hot on the heels came the rush of excitement, the startled joy of discovery, the blush of success. Sure, she was only trying to lift the stain from the carpet so her mother wouldn't find out about her clumsy attempt at smoking, but it was something, right? Later at breakfast, she absent-mindedly cursed and levitated the milk. Her mother cried out in delight, "Your first spell!" Araya didn't have the heart to tell her the truth. There were so many spells after that first one. Spells to hide herself from the cops when they came to break up parties. Spells to knock down fences when she got angry at the neighbor for trimming back the oak tree on the property line, the one she used to go climb when she needed to be alone, to stop the itch under her nails and behind her eyes, and the spells wanting to escape. Spells to stop zits on the night before prom. Spells that wanted to be free of her but were still a part of her, so each one felt like a little loss as the words fell away from her lips. Spells to make the beat-up Honda she got for her birthday start again after it broke down on the side of the highway at night, in the country, coming back from her boyfriend's house. Spells to get boyfriends to love her. Spells to stop boyfriends from loving her. Spells that couldn't stop the boyfriend in college who didn't believe in the power of the word no. Spells to give the word no the power it deserved, bestowed on the girls in her dorm and then every girl on campus and then every woman who found her in the little boutique she set up on 6th Street. Women who stumbled upon it, drunk or broken or faceless or numb. "I just need a spell for him," they said, or sometimes for her, and once for them, the pronouns dripping with meaning, but none could solve the bigger problem. Spells to make cops see the women were telling the truth, to make people believe. And if she counted up the spells in her life, she might have saved that first one for something better, something more meaningful, something less adolescent and foolish. Araya knew too late that each spell was nothing, if not a band-aid. She should have been spelling senators and presidents and judges. When she looked back on that girl she used to be, she didn't regret her mistakes, only the spells.
At 35, she felt them squeaking out of her, growing thin. Her belly felt tight, empty, and she sunk a wish in her heart, a stone of a wish that seemed to stick in the back of her throat, that she hadn't helped all those women. But that was a mean, hard thought, and she swept it from her mind before it got too close to her, before it tried to whisper in her ear, before it fell from her lips. Araya tried to tell herself the need to have a child wasn't the need to fill the emptiness. She felt the last spell coming when her daughter kicked beneath her hand in her belly. It was expectant, that spell. And when the nurses wrapped her daughter up and deposited the squirming, so very pink baby in her arms, Araya closed her eyes and cast the last spell. She tried to make it count. She wrapped all the memories of all those women up in her words and wished for a better way for this, her baby girl, and every baby girl to come.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading The Flight Stone by K.J. Kobza. Editor's note, disturbing, for adult readers. Never forget, ladies, how lucky you are, says Miss Reaper all the time. You could have died in an alley from plague or starvation, or grown up to become disgusting harlots. But the Harkish Crown, in its wisdom and mercy, has lifted you out of the gutters and has given you a great destiny instead. The least you can do is repay its kindness. So pay attention. Miss Reaper is the headmistress. Her school, outside of Hark's city walls, is where you go to become an air knight. You can only be an air knight if you're a street orphan first. A land horse can carry a big man and all his gear, but an air horse can only take off with a really light load. I heard they tried regular kids at first, but they always grew too big and got too heavy. They have to use starving ones. Ceri is my friend. She is shorter than me, even though she's much older. Her upper arms are skinnier than her forearms, and her thighs don't touch together. She'll be an air knight forever. I heard they're going to start using dwarves, she whispers to me one day over breakfast. Isn't that stupid? We always eat outside in the assembly yard so Miss Reaper can make sure we don't cheat. We have to eat exactly what they give us. No more, no less. Light and strong, Miss Reaper says. Like little butterflies. Why would they use dwarves? Ceri wrinkles her nose. They think we can't decide for ourselves, like we're too young. Kaya leans forward. But they let us decide about whether to go back. They took Lynn back to Hark last fall when she wanted to leave, remember? Exactly, says Ceri. Remember, ladies, Miss Reaper says, pointing to the flight stone in the center of the yard. Little butterflies, not big clumsy rocks. Ceri will graduate and be a full air knight when the next accounting comes. We all know she's ready. She's old enough, and she's stopped getting taller. But I haven't. I worry about it all the time. I'm not like Lynn. I don't want to go back to Hark and sleep in a doorway under crawling rats. I want to keep riding air horses. The air horses are the most beautiful things there are. You can see through their skin, like glass. They have narrow heads, like hunting dogs, and their eyes change color every time they blink. When they open their wings, it's silent and cold, like mist going over the moon. I want to be an air knight forever, too, but I only will if I stop growing in time. Air horses can't take off with anything heavier than the flight stone, and if the pan you stand on come accounting day goes down to the grass, and the flight stone's pan goes up, you go back to Hark, whether you want to or not. I learned from Kaya how to cheat. I don't like making sick, but I like it when I take off on all that beautiful flying glass, and all I can hear is wind. Caliph, says Miss Reaper during lunch one day, come with me. She leads me away from the yard and into the doctor's building. "I've been watching you at morning drills," says Miss Reaper, as Dr. Hatch looks hard at me and pokes my skin all over. "You seem to be tiring out easily. Why is that?" "I'm not tired," I lie. Dr. Hatch examines my fingers and touches my hair.
"Mm-hmm," says Miss Reaper.
"Maybe you have a cold. Starve a fever but feed a cold," they say. "I'm not sick." "I dare say you are." I don't answer her. I look away at Dr. Hatch's tools. She has a lot of them. Big scary scalpels and big scary bone saws. "The Harkish Crown is not in the business of abusing children," says Miss Reaper. "We select you girls for your naturally smaller size, innocently begotten from your early harsh life on the streets. Do you understand? We do not want girls to behave contrary to nature, if nature can remedy what your earlier misfortune has brought." "Oh, yeah," Lynn used to say sarcastically. "They take really great care of us now. I had more to eat back when I stole bones from the butcher." "I understand," I say. "From now on, at the end of mealtimes, you will come straight to Dr. Hatch. She will watch you and make sure you behave yourself until you have proven to me that you can be trusted to keep down everything you've been given. Is that clear?"
"Yes, headmistress."
Dr. Hatch talks. "It's not bad," she says. "She hasn't been doing it for long." "Good," says Miss Reaper. "You must always nip these things in the bud." Sitting in Dr. Hatch's office, sometimes I think about nipping buds. I feel like a branch with most of its buds already nipped off. But even like this, I'm still too big and clumsy to fit into my vase. And I think about how my legs are kind of like branches coming out from my knees, and my feet are like big clumsy buds, and how loud and cold it is inside the wind when you fly, and how warm the glass air horse is underneath you, and how air horse harnesses are different from land horse saddles. You don't need anything below your knees to ride an air horse. Dr. Hatch gets up from her desk and says, "I'm going to the latrine." I watch her leave. There's a rumor going around that Miss Reaper goes into the assembly yard every night with a chisel and takes an itty-bitty piece out of the flight stone, like a kind of secret game. Either way, I'm not going to lose. I go to Dr. Hatch's tool case and take out the bone saw.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.